In this hour, Focus 580 will explore some of the history of the development of the laser and look specifically at a long legal battle that stretched over something like 30 years over ownership of the idea, essentially, looking at this question, who was it that invented the laser? And our guest for the program is Nick Taylor. He's a journalist. He's written a book on this subject, particularly about the efforts of one individual, a man named Gordon Gould, to get the rights to the laser. His claim was that he had invented it, and he was eventually vindicated in court, although it took a lot of money and a long time. It still seems to be, though, a rather a point of contention, just exactly who it is, at least in some people's minds, a point of contention, who it is that invented the laser. So we'll explore some of the territory this morning with Nick Taylor. His book, by the way, is titled Laser, The Inventor, the Nobel Laureate, and the 30-Year Patent War. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Our guest, Nick Taylor, is the author or co-author of 8 books, including the national bestseller John Glenn, A Memoir. He's also written many articles for magazines, including Esquire and the New York Times Magazine, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome from people listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Taylor, hello.
David, thank you. I'm glad to be with you this morning.
Let's start out talking right away about Mr. Gould. And it's interesting that, you know, you talk in the story about the fact that when he got to the point where he was making the claim in court that indeed he was the fellow who came up with this idea, he even came up with the name, his claim was ridiculed for a number of reasons, because he did not have a PhD, because he didn't happen to be an award-winning scientist or a college professor. But when you look at his background, the kind of person he is, he certainly seems to be he's like an inventor from Central Casting, so much like his hero, Tom Edison, one of those people who seems to come up with ideas because they just think about things differently or look at things differently. And for that reason, then they come up with novel sorts of solutions to problems that other people just don't get because they don't think that way.
Well, that's exactly right. And for a physicist, as Gould was, with a training in optical physics, he had this incredible gift, which was to be able to see these physical processes at work. He could actually imagine the movement of light waves, and that was what helped him come up with the essential concept of the laser as a graduate student in 1957. And it was because he was not an academically oriented research scientist. He didn't care about publications very much. He didn't go to all the right meetings. And he didn't even have a PhD. He was dismissed for years and years and had to engage in this 30-year war of litigation.
He apparently was someone who, even before he came up with this idea for the laser, did have ideas and always seemed, though, particularly to be interested in optics.
Well, he was interested in optics. He loved the beauty of optical phenomena. He could imagine what was going on when, if indeed he ever did, look at the Aurora Borealis, for example. But he always wanted to invent things, and he always wanted to invent useful things from which he could make money. What led him into Columbia as a relatively older graduate student was that he had an idea that he might be able to take an industrial diamond, put it in a vacuum chamber, heat it up, and just precipitate carbon on it in such a way that the carbon would turn hard and become transparent and make the diamond grow. Well, all he got was smudgy little diamonds, and so that was what led him back to Columbia and to learn more about physics so that he could actually invent something that would be practical.
Hmm. So in 1949, he applied to Columbia to study physics, and I think you suggest that his choice of Columbia was mostly a matter of convenience, but it seems that that because of the people he came into contact with, it turned out that being at Columbia was important, and in fact, maybe if he had gone someplace else, you know, who knows, things might have taken a different course.
Well, that's exactly right. Columbia was one of the premier physics institutions in the country, along with schools like MIT and Harvard and University of Chicago, Caltech. And this place was full of past and future Nobel laureates. This very intense program that really didn't care much about the graduate students, but it was rigorous, and the people that emerged from it, continued to win Nobel Prizes at an amazing rate. And so while he chose it because he had been teaching physics to undergraduates at City College of New York, now City University of New York, which was just a few blocks uptown from Columbia, from the Columbia campus in Manhattan, it was certainly a good choice for what he was wanting to do.
Now let's talk a little bit about Charles Townes, who was a professor there at Columbia when Gould went there to work on his PhD. And in fact, they were, I guess, their offices were nearby.
They were next door to one another.
He developed a device called a maser. So this is M-A-S-E-R. Let's talk about that a little bit. What is a maser?
Well, a maser it's an acronym, just like laser is. It stands for microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And Townes, a brilliant scientist who considerably after this won a Nobel Prize, realized that Einstein had predicted that atoms and molecules could be stimulated to emit their radiation, but nobody had ever done it until Townes realized how the theory that it took to allow this to happen, and he built a device that amplified microwaves and created a standing wave. The difference between the maser and the laser is remarkable in that light waves are just enormously more powerful, 10,000 times more powerful than microwaves, and it requires a different kind of cavity to contain and steer them. And that was what Gould essentially came up with, as well as ways to amplify, to begin the process of what we call lasing today.
So was Gould was involved in some of the work that went into producing the maser?
Yes, he was. He hit on an idea called optical pumping. He didn't invent it. It was invented by a French scientist named Alfred Kastelet. And when I.I. Robbie, who was head of the physics department at Columbia, came back and told Gould that he had seen this process in France, Gould adapted it for his thesis project. Working from that, he approached Townes with the idea of using optical pumping to stimulate a maser. Townes later used this information, which he got from Gould and also contended that he got from other sources, to amend his maser patent to make it much more valuable, and in fact used it to license laser manufacturers when the laser began to be a commercially viable device. So Gould was involved in optical pumping of the maser, and of course Townes and his brother-in-law later became the first patent holders on the laser.
Now here it sort of gets us down to the proverbial bone of contention. When Gould had these ideas before he had his eureka moment and wrote it all down, when Gould had these ideas and he discussed them with Townes, how fully formed in Gould's mind was the concept at that point?
Well, when they had their discussions, Townes was certain inventions among research institutions sort of get in the air. People realize that, and when Townes invented the maser, after that scientists and researchers started thinking, well, how can we bring this down to light wave frequencies? So it was an idea that a lot of people were thinking about. Gould was thinking about it, Townes was thinking about it, his brother-in-law, Arthur Shallow, was thinking about it. And Townes had, in fact, created the underlying formula, which is one thing. But the business of containing and steering the light waves is another thing entirely, as is the business of stimulating the beginning of the whole process, which is the amplification process. And Gould was the first person to come up with the idea of using mirrors at each ends of a maser cavity to steer those light waves back and forth until they became powerful enough that one would emerge through a partially transparent mirror and become the laser beam that we know today, that very sharp, very columnar, straight line that doesn't disperse at all the way light from a flashlight does, for example.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that Towns, I think, has a different version of this story. In fact, I think a couple of years ago he published his version in an autobiography, which was titled How the Laser Happened.
Yes.
And I know that at least one of the reviewers who's reviewed your book kind of takes you to task for making the argument that Gould was the inventor, and the reviewer seems to suggest that it's just not that clear that in fact, in a way, they're both sort of the inventor. In your mind, is it really that clear that if we're going to say there should be that we're going to take one person, that it should definitely be Gordon Gould?
Well, Gould coined the word laser. Gould did have this 1957 notebook, which preceded by 6 months anything that Towns and Shallow did. On the other hand, Towns did invent or theorize the underlying formula that that made the maser work, and as an outgrowth of that, the laser. Gould was responsible for two vital forms of amplifying or beginning the lasing process. Optical pumping, which we discussed earlier, was one, and the other was collisions of the second kind, in which atoms and molecules collide with one another and stimulate a radiation one from the other. And I think that the reviewer, and that was Michael Riordan, a scientist writing in the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
My book really wants to put Gordon Gould in the lexicon of laser inventors, where he had been prevented from being, both by the scientific establishment, which rallied around Towns, and by all the laser manufacturers and users who didn't want to have to pay him royalties. So rather than trying to put Gould into history as a sole inventor of the laser, I think what I was trying to do was to make sure he got his fair share of the credit.
Hmm. Interestingly enough, just for grins this morning, I clicked onto the online Encyclopedia Britannica and looked up laser, and in their article there on laser, there is no mention of Gordon Gould.
Well, they're one of the few today that don't do that any don't mention Gould. You'll find a number of other scientific encyclopedias that do put Gould where he belongs, as one of the early laser pioneers, and as a person who, as my book explains, really had more better ideas. I mean, almost none of the ideas that Gould had early on about how to make a laser work, almost none of them didn't work. They almost all did. And, you know, not to take anything away from Charles Towns, who is certainly a great scientist and a Nobel laureate, but he was too willing for too long, and probably still is, to dismiss Gordon Gould as having any role at all. And that's just not the fact.
Let me, at this point, introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Nick Taylor. He is a journalist, and he's the author of a book that lays out this story that we're here have just given you the capsule summary of. The title of his book is Laser, the Inventor, the Nobel Laureate, and the 30-Year Patent War. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Other questions, certainly, from people who are listening are welcome. If you'd like to call in, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, just to go back here in the story again to the point where Towns had developed the maser, Gould had worked on that. Gould had some of these ideas that he had discussed with Towns. And apparently that Gould, at this point, decided that Towns and maybe some other people were on the same track. And so he said to himself, you know, I'd better get a patent. And he started to write it up and apparently had, this was in 1957, had this moment of inspiration. And he wrote down in his notebooks his ideas. He came up with he coined the term laser. He talked about possible applications. What happened there? What was the inspiration there that that really made the difference and opened the door?
Well, the inspiration for the two, Gould's inspiration was the two mirrors. The two mirrors at each end. You can imagine a tube, say a paper towel tube, much smaller, of course, with mirrors at each end, and they face each other, and they're parallel, and there's a side of that paper towel tube cut away, and there's an external light that shines onto a medium, say a gas of some kind, in the inside this tube, inside this transparent tube. Well, Gould realized that by flashing that light into the amplifying medium, there are corresponding spectral lines between two elements, and they will excite one another, and the two mirrors at each end of this tube would steer these light waves back and forth in a way that would allow them to build on one another until they became coherent, and that means that they're marching all in the same direction, and the peaks and troughs of the wave are all corresponding. And they would grow through the further stimulated emission radiation until one of those beams at one end would be, or the mirrors rather, would be partially silvered, partially transparent, that is, and the beam would burst through. And that was what Gould put down in that 1957 notebook, as well as realizing at the same time what a powerful force this was, in that the beam, this coherent beam of light, could therefore be concentrated and create temperatures hotter than the sun that could be used for welding and hole drilling, and then the coherent, straight, non-dispersing beam could be used to measure things. It could go from here to the moon and disperse to a breadth of a little more than a mile. It could just be used for all these things. And really, nobody else realized that, including Charles Townes. So Gould was applying his inventor's mind. Townes was applying his scientific mind. He thought of the, he called it an optical maser because, of course, he'd invented the maser. Hmm. He thought the maser could be, would be an interesting scientific tool. Whereas Gould thought, "Wow, look at all the things you can do with this. You can really use this for some very important things." And as we know today, that's the case.
Yeah. Gould apparently at this point he decided, or shortly thereafter, decided to abandon his pursuit of the PhD to pursue the idea of the laser. And while he may have been and is a great inventor, apparently not such a great head for business. And he made one really big mistake here. He somehow got the idea that to get a patent, he had to produce a working laser, which was not required. And so he went out and got a job and tried to persuade this company that he was working for, the Technical Research Group, to fund a project to build the laser.
Well, as I said in the book, Gould wrote his notebook, and he got it notarized at a candy store in the Bronx where he lived at the time, and those were the last smart things he did for quite a while. He was under the misapprehension that he had to actually build a laser before he could patent it, so he left his PhD studies, and he had already done his thesis work. He had everything done except the thesis itself, and took a job with a company called TRG, and very secretively went to work for them. He was supposed to be doing something else, but he actually was working on the laser in his spare time. And finally, he revealed to his employers what he had come up with. And so they took him off his other duties, put him to work on that, and he wrote a second notebook, much more lengthy than the first, and turned the information in that notebook into an application to the Defense Department to study lasers and laser properties. That was both a plus and a minus, as it turned out, for Gould, because the Defense Department said, "Oh, you want $300,000 to study lasers? Here, we're going to give you $1 million." But then it turned out that Gould, who had had a flirtation with communism in the 40s, could never get a security clearance to work on his own invention.
That's a really strange twist to the story. It was something that really dogged him made this strange irony that he came up with this great idea and the government was willing to give him a big bucket of money to do it, and yet he couldn't go in the laboratory where they were doing the work that was trying to implement his idea.
Well, it was just so strange. the rules were that he could people could come and ask him questions, but the questions had to be phrased in such a way that he didn't know what they were doing. So he was reduced to, and this is another thing about Gould, he was really a laboratory physicist. He was an inventor and somebody who had to have his hands on. He could work things through in the laboratory in a way that he wasn't very good at theoretically. And so being taken out of the lab really reduced him to a theoretician. And it was, there were internecine rivalries in the company that he worked for, people who didn't really want to listen to what he had to say and thought their own ideas were better. And as a result, the company that he worked for was, they made one of the early lasers, but they didn't really, weren't front and center. The first person to build a laser was a guy named Ted Maimon at Hughes Research in California.
Did Townes, when he altered his patent, he amended his patent to include this idea of optical pumping.
Yes.
Did he know that Gould was over at TRG and that the folks there were working on trying to build a working laser?
Well, Gould had shown Townes he went to Townes as the inventor of the maser with his idea for optical pumping of a maser, showed him a notebook in January of 1957 that Townes signed. Now, as to whether Townes knew what happened to Gould immediately after he left to Columbia, I don't think so. Because, again, Gould was not the sort of person who went to the same meetings, although he went to some of them. And, in fact, he had talked about optical pumping of a maser at Townes' suggestion to a branch of Columbia out on Long Island. But whether Townes actually knew that Gould was busy trying to build a laser, I don't think he knew that until the patent litigation started, and that was first in the interference process within the patent office.
Mm-hmm. So that was later, and at that point it was when Townes, who apparently didn't think all that much of Gould and seems to have thought even less of him over time, it was Townes' position that, well, Gould certainly must have gotten the idea from him, that is, from Townes.
Well, Gould has suggested that Townes has much too much ego involvement here, that, in fact, Townes was the great scientist, and he could not imagine Gordon Gould, who was a graduate student that Townes has since said he thought was arrested, not getting anywhere, bogged down in his studies. He never thought Gould could do this. He just didn't give him the credit for having the background or the intelligence, I suppose, to do it, because he didn't fit Townes' idea of a proper physicist, a proper scientist.
Hmm. Well, Townes got his patent in 1960, the same year a scientist at Hughes Aircraft produced the first working laser.
That's
Gould
right.
Must have been extremely frustrated because he didn't do either. He didn't have the patent, and the work hadn't there at TRG hadn't really been panning out. So here it was his idea, and somebody else is getting credit for it, and somebody else built the first one. He must have been pretty unhappy.
Well, he was extremely frustrated, but he always believed. He had this kind of, at the core of while he was frustrated and upset on the outside, he has this kind of serene core of self-belief that I did it first. I had more ideas. I had better ideas. And my ideas over time, were proven to work, whereas Townes and Shallow in that first laser that they patented during the patent litigation, it was proven not to work. That the elements that Townes and Shallow had placed into their original patent would have been a non-working laser, and in terms of the patent law, could not be there could be no constructive reduction to practice, which is what they call the actual machine that stems from a described invention.
Hmm. We have a caller. Others are certainly welcome. You have questions, you can call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Oh. Isn't history just littered with individuals like this? Even one as great as Eli Whitney chased his patent of his cotton gin, and I think he failed, didn't he? How about Edison? Didn't he have many problems chasing things, people messing with his patents or saying they'd been invented it before him and such?
Well, that's an excellent point, and that's part of the book. The reason this is because large corporations start using a device or producing a device, and they don't want to pay royalties to the inventor. More recently than the inventors you've mentioned are, well, Philo T. Farnsworth was an early pioneer in television, who all the credit originally went to RCA and Sarnoff. Raymond DeForest invented the vacuum tube and had to fight for half his life to win credit for that, and that was a significant invention. And even more recently, the GE recently had to pay an inventor named Raymond Damadian a nine-figure settlement over the invention of the magnetic resonance imaging at the MRI that transformed medical diagnosis. So it happens all the time. You're absolutely right.
Isn't there a better way to deal with the patent law so these kind of things don't happen, or is it just part of the beast?
Well, I think it's part of the beast. Certainly in the case of the laser, as David's pointed out, the you know, a lot of inventions are movements toward an invention. They become sort of incremental, and they happen around the same time. So sorting out who invented what is very difficult. And in Gould's case, it took 30 years before his efforts were finally realized. I'm not an expert on the patent system, and I'd like to tell people who ask about the book that I thought physics was hard to comprehend until I encountered patent law. So, and it's even more difficult now that business methods and genes are being patented. And it would be nice to think that there's a better way of doing it, but I certainly can't offer any lucid solutions.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Our guest this morning, Nick Taylor. He is the author or co-author of a number of books, including a national bestseller, John Glenn, a Memoir. He's written articles for magazines, including Esquire and the New York Times Magazine, and is the author of the book Laser, The Inventor, the Nobel Laureate, and the 30-Year Patent War. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, indeed, as you say, I think really the second half of this book is the story of this 30-year patent battle, which is something that we can probably only give a thumbnail sketch of, because it's pretty complicated. And if people are interested, they can go and they can look at the book and look at it. But maybe let me ask this question to start into the conversation. What happened when Gould asserted his claim to be the person who came up with the idea for the laser?
Well, it's a multi-part process that begins within the patent office during what is called the interference process. That means when two inventions, or two or more inventions in this case, seem to conflict with one another, it's a way of trying to sort them out. Gould, there were five interferences involving Gould and other inventors. In one case, of course, it was Townes and Arthur Shallow. In another case, there were a number of other cases. One had to do with the with an inventor named Ali Javan, and this had to do with a gas discharge laser. Gould won two of those and lost three, but he kept his claims alive. And the genealogy of an invention looks like the Smith family tree. I mean, it can get very long and very spread out. Once he lost those interferences, his recourse was then in the federal courts for the District of Columbia, and those were routes that he pursued. He ended up, while that first notebook described the mirrors, and what is called a laser oscillator, which is the bouncing back and forth of the light waves, Gould eventually amended his patent applications to seek patents on amplifiers, which is, as we talked about before, the process that starts a laser working. And that was where he was ultimately successful, that in patents on the uses of lasers, and then in a relatively minor device that's contained within practically every laser to reduce reflection losses. So this fight was carried out within the patent office first, and then within the courts, and then later, because of the result of a new law that was passed by Congress while all this was going on, back within the patent office.
You know, one of the questions that occurs to me, it's really the same question, I think, that is posed at one point by a patent lawyer that Gould was talking with. This was in 1976, so it was already that many years later the lawyer said, you know, looked at the notebook, the notarized 1957 notebook, the one that where Gould first lays out the idea, where he coins the term laser, where he talks about possible applications, all of this before Townes applied for his patent. And so the lawyer says to Gould, so why didn't you get the patent? What, given the fact that he had that document, why in 1976 was it still an issue?
Well, because, I hope we don't get too bogged down in details here, but because the patent office decided that he had not said specifically that the side of his cavity in which the lasing medium was to be contained was transparent, and would have had to be transparent. I mean, he drew this diagram, and it seemed clear to him that it was transparent, but he didn't say so in so many words. Mm-hmm. So he was bounced out of contention on that issue because he didn't say, imagine a transparent tube. Mm-hmm. So that was what happened there. And then the reason he didn't have any patents at that point, well, he was issued one patent in 1977, that his enemies have been trying to fight him for so long, because the laser industry was developing, and there was a point at which the stakes were high enough that the manufacturers didn't want him to have any patents.
This does seem like a small point about the transparent sides, and yet it seems to be important in the sense that he didn't specifically say, yeah, the sides of the box need to be transparent, and yet apparently people who really understood the technology would look at it and say, well, of course the sides need to be transparent. There's no question about that. You shouldn't even have to specify that. So then that leads to the question, well, okay, the guys who are approving the patents, maybe they don't know what they should about the technologies that they're issuing patents for.
Probably some inventors would agree with you. The Townes and Shallow, of course, had their patent, and it was only later that it was learned, or at least this laser, couldn't work, or at least it's never been made to work. So, you can argue, of course, that the patent office didn't know what it was doing in issuing that patent. You have to remember, though, David, that it was the description of a device that is patented is supposed to be sufficient to allow someone, in the words of the patent office, skilled in the art, to build it. Hmm. And in 1957, 1958, 1959, there were only a handful of people in the whole United States and around the world that would have been skilled in the art enough to build a laser from anybody's description, let alone a relatively bare bones one that Gould provided in his 1957 notebook. There have been arguments. Gould's partisans say they could. Townes' partisans say they couldn't have built. No one skilled in the art could have built a laser based on that original description of Gould's in 1957, although that was not the case with his later notebook and his proposal to the Defense Department in late 1958.
Hmm. Not only did this legal battle of Gould's take a long time, it was also very costly. And if he had to rely entirely on his own financial resources, he wouldn't have been able to do it.
No.
Where did the money come from that financed this long battle?
When Gould finally realized that he was going to have to pursue this, he realized he was going to have to sell some of the future value of the laser off. And so he went looking for entrepreneurs. He eventually ended up with a patent licensing firm called REFAC here in New York, run by a man named Eugene Lang, who, as an aside, is known as the beginner of the I Have a Dream Foundation. In any case, REFAC and Gene Lang took on Gould's case and also introduced him to patent lawyers who agreed to contribute $300,000 worth of legal time to Gould's fight. That soon proved not to be enough, and Gould kept shaving off little pieces of his future royalties until his share was down to 20%. The litigator's share was up to 65%, and it sort of funded this unlimited battle, but it just points out how deep an inventor's pockets have to be to fight companies like General Motors and AT&T and the major laser manufacturers.
Well, what was the total cost of all of this?
Wow. I don't know if you could actually put a figure on it. Gould, when Gould finally got the four basic patents that he began to, that when they were all in force at the same time, and that was after 1958, he was probably making $6 million a year. And so the other 80% of that would have been $24 million a year. And I never put a figure on, the lawyers were never able to put a figure on how much they actually spent, but I can say that at one point, there was a company called Patlex, Latin for patent law, that or Lex for patent for law, was a publicly traded. It was basically a publicly traded litigation, and the upside was Gould getting his patents and having them confirmed in the courts. And of course, the downside would have been that he didn't get any patents at all, and the investors would have lost all their money.
Well, the end result for Gould, in addition to achieving some vindication, was he did become a wealthy man.
Yes, he did. After all this time, he lives outside of Colorado now in the mountains outside of Denver, and he enjoys a pretty nice life. And at one point, one of his lawyers said, "How in the world did you keep going on for so long?" And he said, "Well, I never thought it would take this long. I always thought the next battle was going to be the last one." But he really did have to fight not only the scientific establishment, but, at one point there was a passage of a reexamination law that allowed third parties to ask that patents be reexamined. And that was when General Motors and AT&T, or Bell Labs, rather, came against him and tried to invalidate the patents that he'd already been issued. And that probably added, 6 or 8 years to his fight and untold costs in litigation.
But certainly, his own tenacity had a lot to do with his ultimate success. The fact that he just did not give up.
He didn't give up because he believed. He knew that he had done what he had done, and he had the documentation. He had that 1957 notebook. He had the later notebook that was the basis for the Defense Department proposal, and he had the experience as time went on of the fact that almost all of his laser ideas had been proven to work, that all of the uses that he had predicted and more had come to pass, and he was just absolutely secure in the belief, the knowledge, that he had been there at the beginning and was, if not the sole inventor of the laser, one or two of its most significant pioneers.
We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. One more time here, I want to introduce our guest. We're talking with Nick Taylor. If you'd like to read this book, it's titled Laser, And it's published by Simon & Schuster. It's out in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. Questions, of course, are also welcome here, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, when you think about Gould's motivation, why it is that he was so tenacious and stuck with his battle for so long, and you weigh the various motivations, one being sort of the principle of the thing, his belief that indeed he was the guy who came up with the idea, another perhaps being related to that his place in history, and then not to be ignored, the money that he stood to make if indeed he was acknowledged as the guy who came up with the idea. How does one rank the importance of those various things in how they all come together to produce this determination to stick with it?
Show me the money. That was what Gould said from the beginning. I know from having spent a great deal of time with him and interviewed him dozens of times that he also cares a great deal about his place in scientific history and the fact that he really was there at the beginning and he was, he had these ideas. But he's always said, perhaps a little dismissively, that it was the money that motivated him from the very beginning. It was certainly the idea, the prospect of inventing things that would be practical, useful, and would sell that motivated him to become an inventor. But I think that as time went on and he was dismissed by the scientific greats, that he there was a little payback involved as well.
Hmm. We have another caller here, Champaign County, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. As the earlier caller pointed out, this is common for in the history of inventors, corporations taking and doing various things, machinations to get rights, not to pay the inventor. It also strikes me that it's also common in academic milieus for the graduate student to have his ideas. I'm surprised nobody called in with that who was actually a grad student. The other thing I wanted to know is, did he actually try to make... the first lasing device was a ruby, right?
That's correct.
Was he trying to get one to work? I mean, did he have... and he just never got it to lathe, or, I mean, he just had the idea, or did he actually work with, devices? And I'll have to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, that's a good question, because the first laser was a ruby, a small rod of ruby. Gould's expertise was not in solids. It was in gases. And he, while people at his company were working with ruby, he was the people who were working most closely with him to the extent that they could, and again, he couldn't go into the laboratory, were working with gases, and they were working on a scheme involving cesium and helium, which they didn't get to work before other people had done something similar. But that was why he didn't make a ruby laser work before Ted Maiman out at Hughes in California.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that at one point, this was in 1960, just how frustrated Gould was when Townes secured the patent for the optically pumped maser, and then somebody else, the guy at Hughes, actually produced the first working laser. In 1964, Townes, along with two Russians, received the Nobel Prize in physics. It didn't say specifically for inventing the laser, but apparently the anybody who knew anything about it would have figured, well, that's really what it is we were talking about here. How did Gould feel about Townes winning the Nobel Prize?
Well, I think that he thought when it was announced that Townes had won it for the maser and for the underlying theory, and as well as the Russians, and But of course, Townes always never argued with anybody who thought that he'd been awarded the Nobel Prize for invention of the laser. I don't think Gould ever expected to win a Nobel Prize. I think he might have liked to be considered, but this goes to your earlier question. He was probably more concerned about whether he was ever going to be able to license laser manufacturers and start making some money.
Yeah. We're here down to the point where I have a couple of minutes left. Just one other question I'm interested in asking you, and it sort of goes to the issue of, as a writer, what you think is an important part of the story. The Gould's personal life, his private life, is certainly part of the story that you tell, and you talk about his background, his growing up, some marriages, some love affairs, all sorts of things that some people might say was secondary to the story, to the scientific part of the story. And I'm interested in why it is you felt that that was also important and something that you wanted to include.
Well, because Gould's an interesting man, and he's in many ways a product of his demons. The fact that he was attracted by the way his eventual first wife walked was what led him into communism. She was a staunch communist who got him involved in Marxist study groups and eventually in a local party that was a cell of the American Communist Party, a local party here in New York. And so he was, you couldn't separate his sexual proclivities, his paranoia in not wanting to reveal any of his inventions, and the fact that he, he had this personal life, from its effect on his effort to win credit. Maybe it wouldn't have taken him 30 years if he had been a more abstemious and regular sort of person, but he wasn't. He was who he was, and that's part of the story.
Well, it's quite an interesting story. At this point, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading more, again, the title of the book is Laser, the Inventor, the Nobel Laureate, and the 30-Year Patent War, published by Simon & Schuster. Nick Taylor is the author. Mr. Taylor, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, it's been my pleasure to be with you.